Another tragic gun shooting in America, and once again, the rest of the world is baffled by U.S. gun policy.
In Australia, when we were confronted with a mass shooting, the whole country came together to give up their weapons.
Also today, we speak with someone who's visited a Texas detention facility. This one was designed with COVID protocols in mind to hold 250 children.
And when we were there, there were over 2,000 children.
And tensions in the South China Sea have been growing. So to confront China, the U.S. military is working with an old enemy.
Vietnam has been willing to stand up against China's bullying behavior.
I'm Marco Werman, and another large fire rips through the world's largest refugee camp in Bangladesh.
Basically, most people are saying this is not an accident.
The stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Another American city, another tragic shooting, this time in Boulder, Colorado, in a grocery store. A 21-year-old man from a Denver suburb was charged today with 10 counts of first-degree murder, including the killing of Boulder police officer Eric Talley. Here's Boulder Police Chief Maris Herold speaking last night.
My heart goes out to the victims of this incident, and I'm grateful for the police officers that responded.
In 2018, when a gunman shot and killed five people at the Capital Gazette in Annapolis, Maryland, it was the job of then-Mayor of Annapolis, Gavin Buckley, to respond. Mayor Buckley joins us now. Mayor, you've had the unfortunate experience of leading a city in the aftermath of a tragic shooting like this. What message do you have for leaders and community members in Boulder?
Well, obviously, our heart goes out to every person in that community. We know how devastating this is on a personal level to lose one of your first responders. These guys go into these dangerous situations without any regard for their own safety. And obviously that's what happened on that day and that tragic day that person's life was lost. I want to say to any municipality in this country, you could be next. If we don't start to get control of our policies on gun ownership and who these guns are getting into the hands of, we are going to continue to be dealing with these situations. And we have to address it as a nation.
So you were born in South Africa, Mayor Buckley, but you also grew up in Australia and have strong family ties there. I think we can say safely the U.S. is an outlier in the world when it comes to firearm ownership and culture. What difference has your perspective given you when these shootings in the U.S. occur?
I mean, the whole world looks at America when it comes to gun control and scratches their head, right? These are not situations that happen in other parts of the world, only in this part of the world. The amount of guns we have in a country of this population is staggering. And, you know, the type of guns we have is baffling as well. We understand you need a gun for sport and sometimes for protection, but you don't need the different types of weapon that we see are on the street. And that's what the world is asking. In Australia, when we were confronted with a mass shooting, the whole country came together to give up their weapons because we couldn't imagine what it must have been like for that community. It's a very different situation here.
That was following a mass shooting in Tasmania. There was a gun buyback program. Can you talk a bit more about that and how Australia generally has responded to gun violence?
I mean, it started from the top. The Prime Minister, John Howard, stepped forward and said, we are going to have a national campaign to buy back weapons. If you want to just hand your weapon in, please hand your weapon in. And many people came forward to do that voluntarily. It wasn't forced upon them, but they realized that mass shootings are not something they want to be part of, and they want to be things that are associated with our country. It brought people together. It didn't divide them.
So what would you say makes a difference between the U.S. and, say, Australia or the New Zealand mindset where this kind of tragedy occurs and there's a move to change things? I mean, New Zealand had the Christchurch mosque attack in 2019, and like Australia, the head of the country quickly proposed solutions, whereas here it's mass shooting after mass shooting, thoughts and prayers, and we Americans then just wait for the next one to happen.
I mean, I think we have to move away from the guns, guts, and God thing, you know, this rugged individualism. There was a moment in history when we would ask what we could do for our country, not what can my country do for me. The culture of me has to change. It has to be a collective we. And then if it's a collective we, and if we feel like the kids at Sandy Hook could have been our kids, or the people in Charleston could have been people we go to church with, the more we identify with that it could be any of us, and that guns are not partisan. It's a thing that we have to come together on, and we have to reduce the amount of options that are out there for people that want to do bad things.
Mayor Buckley, the last time we spoke with you, 2018, in the aftermath of that terrible shooting at the Capitol Gazette, you mentioned the idea of a national soul-searching, something you believe should take place after such shootings. Do you still think about that? And as you consider the idea, what would that look like today in America?
I mean, we have to soften our hearts. We have to think that we can't continue like this. Look, we have to see that there is a massive amount of pent-up aggression, anxiety. We have to come up with a solution to make people understand that it's not a personal thing against them. We're not trying to take away anyone's liberties, but we're just trying to keep everybody's kids safe.
Mayor, it sounds like you're fearful of this increasing again, these kinds of shootings.
I definitely think that's going to happen, yeah. I'm very scared. I'm scared for the trauma that was caused to all the families that have been victims of mass shootings. Every time there is a new act of violence like this in the country, they have post-traumatic stress inflicted on them again. You know, they have to relive those moments. You know, how many is it going to take for us to realize that no country should act like this and that we have to solve it collectively?
If we're talking real change, what is the way forward? What are we Americans missing or ignoring, do you think?
We have to have less guns on the street, and we have to have less different types of guns. You should be able to have a recreational weapon if you need it. But what do you need a weapon that fires hundreds of rounds for? What do you need some of these armor-piercing bullets for? What does a normal citizen need that kind of firepower for? Nothing. It's just some machismo. I'm not sure what it is, but we have to address it. That the weapon doesn't make you or whatever it is. There's this false narrative of protecting your homestead, pending home invasion, which are very, very rare, right? The fear far outweighs the reality of most people's daily lives.
So, Mr. Mayor, as we think about the victims and survivors in Boulder today, I'm just curious, what has been the impact after 3 years in Annapolis since the shooting there?
And I want to say this to every city that has this unfortunate thing descend on them, that you struggle year after year on how you're going to pay respect to the people who lost their lives and the families that lives were impacted by it. So we are currently clearing ground for a Guardians of the Free Press Memorial in the city of Annapolis now. We selected a site and we funded a site where the five victims will have a memorial, and that will be on the 28th. Every year you question how you can honor and respect what happened and never forget. And so every city has to do that year after year after year. And then some cities are defined by it. We can't let that keep happening. We can't let that be the city that's defined by the mass shooting of a school, or that city is defined by the mass shooting of a church or a mass shooting of a shopping center that was predominantly Hispanic. We can't live like this. And we have to recognize that.
Annapolis, Maryland, Mayor Gavin Buckley had his own experience in 2018 leading a city after a mass shooting. He's been speaking with us in the aftermath of yesterday's shooting in Boulder, Colorado. Mr. Mayor, thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Marco. Thank you for tackling this issue.
The South China Sea covers an area larger than India. About one-third of all global trade passes on cargo ships through those waters. In that respect, it may be the most important body of water on Earth. China's government says the South China Sea belongs to them. The United States doesn't agree, and to resist China's dominance of those waters, America is teaming up with a former enemy. Here's the world's Patrick Nguyen.
Last week, China's Navy did some major training in the South China Sea. It's been doing a lot of that lately, even sending in big warships, which are armed with high-tech Gatling guns that can blow smaller boats to pieces. A Chinese sailor on the warship will confirm the target. And the gun fires, making this metallic roar. That weapon can fire 1,000 bullets in 15 seconds. And China released this video footage on state TV to make a point. The South China Sea is ours, and we can force trespassers to leave. Only every other nation along the sea, five of them, say no, parts of the sea are clearly ours. But their navies can't scare China away. And that's where America comes in, or rather sails in, or flies in jets, provoking China's military to send warnings over the radio.
Leave immediately and keep far off so as to avoid any misunderstanding.
Keep far off to avoid any misunderstanding. Now, there is one country along the sea that not only has a pretty good navy, but also the bravado to confront China's warships. That is Vietnam.
Vietnam has been willing to stand up against China's bullying behavior.
China is the bully here, says Le Hong Hiep. He's a Vietnamese political scholar based in Singapore with the Institute of Southeast Asian Studies. And get ready, he says, for the U.S. and Vietnam to increasingly see each other as comrades. This trend has been building for a while, but during the Biden administration, Hiep believes this relationship will really take off. That U.S. invasion in the 1960s that killed millions of people, water under the bridge.
There is now increasing level of mutual trust between the two former enemies.
U.S. aid to Vietnam is on the rise, and the U.S. is more quiet about human rights in the communist state. Washington is all about building up Vietnam's navy, giving them ships and drones and radar. Vietnam has even let America park an aircraft carrier right off its shores. And some leaders in Hanoi are not crazy about working with America, Hiep says, but it does send a message.
If China hurts Vietnam, Vietnam will be willing to consider upgrading military and defense cooperation with the U.S.
But Hiep says Vietnam's military still has red lines it will not cross.
That is no foreign base on Vietnamese soil.
No foreign bases. Makes sense. Vietnam has been invaded by France, Japan, America, and China. But Vietnam has also said it will never forge any military alliance with a foreign power. And this friendship with the U.S. is bending that rule. But Hanoi feels that's how it has to be. Because here's what can happen when China and Vietnam meet on the high seas. China's Coast Guard ramming a Vietnamese vessel. This happens a lot. In fairness, Beijing says Vietnamese boats have rammed us literally thousands of times. But what's clear is that China is winning this contest. Look at the big picture. There are no large islands in the South China Sea. They're all smaller than, say, Central Park in Manhattan. But China dumps sand to make them bigger, then turns them into fortresses with precision missiles and runways for fighter jets. Come too close, and China will say, get lost.
This is Chinese Navy. Please go away quickly in order to avoid long judgment.
That was a warning to U.S. aircraft. American pilots reply by saying something like this.
I am a United States military aircraft conducting lawful military activities outside national airspace.
Between the U.S. and China, that's about as heated as it gets. They do not ram each other. No one wants to start a war. But under Biden, the U.S. will keep buzzing these island bases created by China. Biden's security advisor, Jake Sullivan, says they should do this more because, quote, China then has to stop us, which they will not do. So it's a game of chicken. I asked Hiep, the scholar, to describe his outlook on where this is all headed.
Not very positive for the future peace and stability in the South China Sea.
He says Vietnam would really prefer to be left alone. But if the country is sucked into a clash between two superpowers, that's something Vietnam knows all too well. For the world, I'm Patrick Nguyen.
Too many kids crammed into too small a space in a border detention center. An insider view, that's coming up next. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with the world. As more unaccompanied migrant children and teens continue to seek entry into the U.S., detention facilities along the border are being stretched beyond their limits. One of them is in the city of Donna, Texas, run by Customs and Border Protection. Attorney Neha Desai visited earlier this month to interview unaccompanied migrant children being held there. Desai is the director of immigration at the National Center for Youth Law. Neha, describe for us, if you would, the facility you visited. How large is it, and how much of it were you able to see?
I can't describe to you the facility itself since we were not permitted to do a tour. We were limited to a particular trailer, essentially, where we were meeting directly with children and interviewing them. The capacity of the facility implementing the COVID restrictions was about 250 kids, and when we were there, there were over 2,000 children.
Wow. So when it came to speaking with the children there, what were they able to tell you about what the conditions are like that they've been living in inside? What is it like inside, and how have they been treated?
What we heard from the children at Dana directly reflected the fact that the facility was dramatically overcrowded and children were spending far longer there than they should have been. So the children that we spoke to were frankly terrified and confused. They didn't know why they were there. They didn't know where they'd be going next. They didn't know when they'd be released. They didn't know when they'd be able to speak with their family. They didn't know why they weren't able to interact with their siblings that were at the same facility but in different pods. Some of the challenges just day to day had to do with the space limitations that were there, being overcrowded, you know, when they were trying to sleep, unable to do anything all day. They described that the only time they got up was to throw something in the trash or go to the bathroom.
What is supposed to happen when unaccompanied children arrive at a center like this?
So typically they either present at a port of entry or they're apprehended by Border Patrol agents, after which they're transferred to customs and border protection facilities, such as the one at Dana. Then after that, once a child is determined to be an unaccompanied minor, they're supposed to be transferred within 72 hours to the Office of Refugee Resettlement, where they're placed in facilities that are state licensed as child care facilities. These facilities are much more appropriate for children and have to meet a number of requirements in order to be licensed and to be a part of this ORR network. And then finally, they're supposed to be released promptly to sponsors who are typically their family members here in the United States.
How much is that actually kind of matching what's happening today?
Many children are spending far too long in CBP custody before they're being transferred to the Office of Refugee Resettlement because there are not sufficient beds within the ORR network. There are a number of steps that are occurring right now to both increase the bed capacity within the Office of Refugee Resettlement, but also to expedite the release of children that are currently in ORR. And I think that's a very important piece of this. It's not just about building more and more spaces. It's about making sure that the kids that are in ORR custody are being rapidly released as safely as possible.
So some of us will remember the images from a few years ago, kids with those shiny silver Mylar blankets crowded into tight spaces. Those scenes continued into the Trump years. What is different today?
So the main facility that was being used during those years where people think about kids in cages, that's a facility that's no longer in operation. The Dana facility that we visited is actually a fairly new facility. There are no cages there, but certainly there are too many children in the spaces designed for Customs and Border Protection.
U.S. Customs and Border Protection released a statement saying they are continuing to transfer unaccompanied minors to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services as quickly and efficiently as possible. That's the statement. Is that the right course of action here? And what is the first thing you think the government should be doing better?
That absolutely is the right course of action. Children need to be transferred as rapidly as possible out of the Customs and Border Protection facilities into the facilities that I mentioned were far more appropriate for children, which is the facilities within the Office of Refugee Resettlement. In the short term, to deal with this immediate situation, it's both increasing the capacity of the Office of Refugee Resettlement and expediting the release of children that are in those facilities. And then in the longer term, there's a lot of work that needs to be done to address the way that we process children here, but also there's much work to be done in the home countries from which children are fleeing to ensure that they are not in a situation where they need to flee for their lives.
Attorney Neha Desai is counsel for plaintiffs in a class action lawsuit representing all children in federal immigration custody. She's been telling us about unaccompanied migrant children held at the Customs and Border Protection holding facility in Dana, Texas, whom she was recently able to interview. Neha, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Marco.
What are local leaders at the border seeing? The mayor of Brownsville, Texas, joins us later on the show. Some good news from East Africa, a steady decline in locust swarms. East Africa has seen its worst outbreaks in decades, causing billions of dollars in crop damage. The next time this happens, though, there's a better plan. The World's Anna Kuzma reports on a company preparing for the next outbreak.
When most people see a field swarming with locusts like these, they see destruction of crops and livelihoods. But Scylla Allen sees an upside.
Our locust projects is getting people thinking about locusts in a different way.
Allen is a manager with The Bug Picture, a company headquartered in Rwanda that has been turning insects into animal feed. Their main business is raising flies, but since January, they've been working on a pilot project that pays farmers in Kenya to collect locusts in their fields.
We issue bags and we issue big plastic sheets.
A locust swarm will roost on crops or trees overnight and become immobilized by the cold.
And you can literally shake the tree and they will fall from the tree onto a black sheet. And then you just pour from the sheet into the sack.
In a video, a group of farmers shake a tree and hundreds of locusts drop into a tarp. Some people pick the locusts by hand. Alan says in their pilot, families were able to harvest hundreds of pounds of locusts in one night.
So we then walk away with the locust, they walk away with the money.
The bugs are then ground up into protein-rich food for livestock. In 6 weeks, the company collected more than 4 tons of locusts, and they're still hunting for more, with plans to scale up for the next outbreak. Tenga Mbi Kersantus is a researcher at the International Center of Insect Physiology and Ecology in Nairobi. He's been researching how to get locusts into the food system for the past few years.
Locusts are extremely rich in protein, comparable to that of most meat protein products.
Tenga says if collection can become more efficient, it could capture locusts before they start reproducing.
This option can be a very good way of even controlling locusts.
Tenga says if people are trained to efficiently capture locusts during outbreaks, there would be less need for pesticides. He says for the operation to scale up, farmers need better tools.
Powerful and cost-effective tools like vacuum pumps.
Locust vacuums. If the government were to support this idea, Tenga says in outbreak years, locusts could become a substantial food source for the country's livestock, replacing expensive imported soy and fish protein.
The potential for harvesting locusts to improve food systems, it's massive. So this is a huge resource.
Locusts by nature are hard to predict. They don't swarm every year. But Bug Picture founder Laura Stanford says she wants the project to grow and spread to other countries.
We can view these locusts as a seasonal crop that comes through every few years. I mean, it might not be as large a disaster next year.
But when it does come, they'll be ready for it. For The World, I'm Anna Kussmer.
And you're with The World. Marco Werman here. It takes a lot to keep the world spinning, but it's listeners like you from all around the globe who spinned for us and helped us exceed our goal of $100,000. These are some of our supporters who span time zones and borders to help keep the world free for everyone. Isabel Floroud, Frederick Breeden, Leslie Stauffer, Brian Garla, Carlin Christie, Kathleen McDonald, David Barrows, Tanya Karras, Harry Botchner, and Patricia Goff. You're the best. Thank you for helping us bring global reporting to millions of people around the world. As more migrants arrive at the U.S.-Mexico border, mayors in nearby towns in Texas are facing the challenges.
It's been a tough few months, but I take it one day at a time.
Also ahead, we remember an Egyptian feminist icon, Nawal el-Saadawi, who fought for women's rights in the Arab world. All that's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We come to you from GBH Boston and PRX. Evening protests in Istanbul, people banging pots and pans from their apartment building windows. The noise is a message to the Turkish government. People are angry with its decision to quit an international treaty preventing violence against women. Turkey's presidential spokesman said the treaty had been, quote, hijacked by a group of people attempting to normalize homosexuality, which is incompatible with Turkey's social and family values, end quote. Thousands of Turkish protesters reject this, saying Turkey faces an epidemic of gender violence. Just yesterday, 4 Turkish women were killed by their romantic partners. Duri Buscarin has this report from Istanbul and a warning. Some of the descriptions in her story are graphic and violent. Please take care while listening.
There's this video from Turkish Twitter that I can't get out of my mind. Hey! Hey! It's filmed from an apartment building, looking onto the street below. A man is punching a woman repeatedly, shaking her by the shoulders and shoving her head into the concrete. Her daughter, who can't be more than 5, stands and watches. Bystanders yell at the man to stop, and he refuses, unashamed. In recent years, Turkish social media has begun to circulate videos of these cases. This story quickly unfolded in local papers. The fight began over a custody dispute. The attacker was the victim's ex-husband. She survived. When the suspect was jailed, he claimed he was drunk. A legal fight continues.
They are attacking our rights. We are unfortunately seeing that we are paying a price with our lives.
Melek Onder is a spokesperson for the We Will Stop Femicides platform, a Turkish organization that tracks the deaths of women in the country. 300 women were murdered by men last year in Turkey, a number that activists fear is even higher than reported.
All women in Turkey is very angry right now.
It was on Friday that Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan announced that Turkey would withdraw from the Istanbul Convention, a treaty among European nations outlining efforts to stop violence against women. It's named the Istanbul Convention because it was first opened for signature here, as a framework of legal policies that, among other things, require countries to make stalking, forced marriage, and sexual violence a crime. Turkey never fully implemented the Istanbul Convention, and Onder says backing out will make Turkey's epidemic of violence against women even worse.
The number of the femicide is increasing, and also we are seeing that the kind of the violence, such as torture or the killing a woman in front of his children, is kind of things are increasing.
Turkey is a place where young people find themselves torn between traditional gender roles and new secular lifestyles. It's not uncommon for extended families to include people living in rural villages who also have relatives living in the US or Germany.
We see that the real gender inequality in Turkey is beginning from the violence in the household.
Nasibe Kırış is a human rights lawyer and political consultant. She sees it this way. As more women in Turkey pursue higher education and professional jobs, they push up against traditional gender roles. Some men, husbands, fathers, ex-boyfriends, feel threatened by this and believe that their role as a man legitimizes this violence. President Erdogan said that the Istanbul Convention shouldn't apply in Turkey because it protects the LGBT community. Kırış says this is simply a way to turn public opinion against the document.
That's why the authorities also using this because they know that the Turkish people's red line is their religion.
Turkish women's groups have embarked on an ambitious schedule of protests throughout the country. One activist has filed a lawsuit against the government's decision to abandon the treaty, arguing that such a move must be ratified by Turkey's parliament. But with politics increasingly dominated by President Erdogan, any change seems unlikely. For the world, I'm Derry Buscarin, Istanbul.
Go to a map of Texas and trace your finger almost all the way to its southeastern tip. And there's Brownsville. To the east, the Gulf of Mexico. To the south, the Rio Grande River, then Mexico. These days, Brownsville is a common crossing point for migrants traveling from Central America. For Brownsville's mayor, Trey Mendez, that's nothing new. Mendez says his town has grown accustomed over the years to seeing the numbers of migrants ebb and flow.
Yesterday, I believe we had a little bit over 200 people cross. It's more than we saw a few months ago, but it's less than we saw a couple years ago. But I do know that there's a significantly larger amount of people being turned away.
So in terms of how these new arrivals are impacting everyday life in Brownsville, what are you seeing?
Quite honestly, it's really not impacting life in Brownsville, and it's for several reasons. The first one is there's a very coordinated process between us and the federal government to transport people to the city. It's not that far, so just transporting them from the bridge to where we process them, and then they're processed at our bus terminal, and then from there, they're assisted with travel arrangements or put in contact with their sponsors, their family. So they're pretty much in and out pretty quickly. The vast majority are gone within 24 hours, mostly even within 12 hours.
Just across the border in Matamoros in Mexico, there was a migrant camp that was serving migrants who had been sent back. What was life like there in that camp?
It was difficult for the people that were there. I worked with the administration and the officials in Matamoros to clear that camp out and make sure that all the people were processed. There are still some people in Matamoros that were part of that program. that are still being transported over, and we're seeing maybe about 50 of those per day right now.
So when the Matamoros camp was open, I gather that some of the citizens of Brownsville had been aiding, sending everything from food and diapers down there. What does it mean for a small city like yours to have filled in that gap?
Well, I think we've been neighbors with Matamoros for the whole entire existence of Brownsville, which was founded in 1848. So we had a lot of really good nonprofits and non-governmental organizations that were assisting. They just did it out of their own goodness of their heart and their own decision to go and help out. I've always said that Brownsville and Matamoros are separated by a bridge, and it really at times has felt like one city. But over the last 10 years or so, it really does feel like two entirely different countries. But I really do want to give credit to those individuals that felt the need to help their neighbors to the south and do what they could to assist those families that were waiting in Mexico for their court date in the U.S.
So I think some listeners will be surprised to hear what you were saying earlier about the city of Brownsville not being deeply affected by what's going on. And while we're hearing the word crisis along the border, and I don't want to dismiss concerns about new child detention centers, but what are you hearing from constituents? What are they telling you? And what can you share with us about this moment?
You do have a lot of people that are concerned, and rightfully so. They are concerned because they don't know a lot of the information, and they're hearing a lot of information from different outlets that tend to have different sets of facts that they convey. So as of now, we're not seeing any real major issues in the city of Brownsville. On the public health side, we are testing all of the individuals that are coming over, and if they test positive for COVID, then they are asked to quarantine. And we do have third-party partners that provide hotel space free of charge if they do test positive.
Mr. Mayor, what do you recommend the U.S. do right now in terms of addressing the rise in migration we're seeing? Are you in direct contact with the Biden administration about migration policy and what to do?
I'm in contact with them probably every day. And there's different approaches, right? I mean, we've seen a system that doesn't seem to work, and it hasn't worked for decades. So the administration is very proactive in trying to find solutions and focusing on root cause issues that are happening in other countries, Central America, South America. And they're also working towards beginning to process and screen a lot of these folks in Central and South America prior to them coming even into Mexico. And they're really trying to discourage people from coming. It is not open borders at this point. Not everybody's allowed to cross. But overall, we do need some sort of legislation that's going to fix this.
I mean, it is a decades-old problem, and you've been living in Brownsville for a long time, so you've seen these news cycles, these political cycles, these migration cycles, and news attention gets focused on your city as though it's under siege. Journalist Enrique Acevedo compared the immigration situation to the pandemic and pointed out that focusing on the border is a bit like focusing just on the ICU or the ER when immigration challenges are so much bigger than just the border. So, Mr. Mayor, how do you stay centered and focused on serving your community?
I take it one day at a time. And the good thing is that I have contact with the administration, and they're doing their part to assist the city as well. They've pledged not to overwhelm us. And it's good to have that communication, and it's good to have, in a way, a seat at the table in trying to address some of the concerns. But it's not something that I see that's gonna go away in the next month or two. One thing about Brownsville is we're a resilient city. We've been through a lot, but we always come out ahead, and I have no doubt we're going to do that again.
Trey Mendez is the mayor of Brownsville, Texas. Mr. Mayor, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Definitely. Thank you, and thank you for the opportunity. Y'all take care.
The Roma people have been treated as second-class citizens, and worse, in much of Europe for centuries. In the Czech Republic, Roma women for years were sterilized against their will. The Czech government has done little to acknowledge that was even happening, and that might be about to change. A new bill that is hoping to compensate these women is going through Parliament in Prague. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Barry reports.
Irene Somalieval was 21 when she went into labour with her third child. At the hospital in Chomutov, a city in the former Czechoslovakia, Somalieval was told she needed to have a cesarean. Before she went under anaesthetic, the doctor approached her with something to sign.
Before operation, doctor, give me some paper. I must sign. I don't know what I'm signing. Because first time, I don't understand language. Don't understand what he said.
Somalieva says she didn't know what she was signing. Her family are Hungarian, and Somalieva knew only a little Czech. She thought she was signing a form agreeing to a C-section. It was sometime later, a nurse told her that she had been sterilised and that she could no longer have any more children. Somalia Va says she was heartbroken.
I go home, I cry in the house. I'm sad for my husband. He's very angry.
Somalia Va says her husband always wanted a son. They had three daughters. After he heard she had been sterilised, he left her, she says. Jonathan Lee with the European Roma Rights Centre says most Roma women in the Czech Republic who were sterilised also saw their marriages break up as a result.
For many of these women who are severely disadvantaged growing up in poverty, their family is everything. To do something like that to them is the worst thing they can possibly imagine, without their consent.
Forced sterilisation was legalised in the Czech Republic in the early 1970s. The country was still part of Czechoslovakia and under communist rule. Doctors even received extra money if they carried out the procedure. The policy didn't name Roma women explicitly, but Lee says the intention was obvious.
It's genocide adjacent. This was an unspoken rule that this was used to reduce the number of Roma who were being born, and with the ultimate goal of either assimilating or removing them from society.
Sometimes the women were coerced into having the procedure, often when they're already in labour. Many thought it was temporary and could be reversed. Gabriela Herobanova is executive director of the European Roma Grassroots Organisations Network. Herobanova, who was born in the former Czechoslovakia, says sometimes the women were offered a financial reward for having the procedure, or threatened if they refused.
They may receive a washing machine, or they may receive a sort of a financial benefits, you know, or they were told that if they would not agree, already existing children will be taken away from them to the orphanage.
Forced sterilisation was officially banned in Czechoslovakia in the early 1990s. But Roma activists like Lee say it continued for years after that.
After communism fell, it was no longer statewide policy. But by this point, it's become very much a culture within the medical practice in the country. So it's strongly suspected, actually, that coerced sterilisations still continue probably to today.
It didn't just happen in the Czech Republic either. In fact, countries across Eastern and Western Europe carried out these procedures on Roma women for decades. Jonathan Lee says the thinking behind these policies is still evident in some parts of Europe today, like in Bulgaria, for example.
The Deputy Prime Minister, Karakachanov, is introducing his alternative Roma integration bill. And one of the points in that is provisions to reduce the number of Romani births. This is the same man who has called for a solution to the gypsy problem in Bulgaria.
Having the bill pass the first stage in Parliament is a big step for Roma women. Here's Gabriela Herobanova again.
This is a real milestone. We were waiting for this for more than 15 years to happen. Many of the victims already died or are getting old. So this is practically the last moment of hope that is being brought for these women.
If the bill is made into law, the women could be entitled to a one-off payment of around $13,000 each. But Herobanova says for most women, it's not about the money.
What we really want is that it is being acknowledged and that it will never happen. I think that would be the most important for women.
There's still a way to go, though. The bill has to go through a series of stages before it's made into law. And Herobanova says a recent survey showed over 60% of people in the Czech Republic do not want someone from the Roma community to be their neighbour. Forced sterilisation may no longer be official government policy, she says, but discrimination against Roma people continues to be widespread. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
An estimated 1 million Rohingya people from Myanmar live in refugee camps in neighbouring Bangladesh. They were forced to leave their homes by the military regime in Myanmar. Now thousands of them have been forced to leave where they resettled because of fire. A massive blaze broke out yesterday at the sprawling refugee camp in the Bangladeshi city of Cox's Bazar. At least five people are reported dead. This fire was just the latest to impact the world's largest refugee camp recently. Kin Maung lives in the camp and witnessed yesterday's event. He's safe today. I asked him how people reacted when the fire broke out.
Basically, most people are saying this is not an accident. This is the information people are saying. People are very upset and suffer because there's a lot of shelter broke down. A lot of people are displaced. Another thing, one of the largest local Rohingya market was destroyed totally.
I mean, it's still under investigation, but what has the Bangladeshi government said so far?
Yeah, Bangladesh government also saying it is under investigation. So we demand an investigation. We also request another thing. You may be a surprise. More than 6 hours, the fire continued burned on, but there is no enough fire service.
Well, Ken, tell me what fire services the camp does have to deal with the kind of emergency you had yesterday.
Yeah, there is no fire service inside of the camp or outside of the camp. Many people cannot see any activity of the fire service to stop this thing.
So while shelters were burning down yesterday, what were people doing?
Yeah, a lot of people are sheltered into their relative people and their family, their relative or their friend.
So people who lost their shelters in this fire, they're staying with relatives in another part of the camp. So
yeah, right. Yeah, right.
Those residences are just getting even more crowded.
Yeah, right.
Kin, how long have you been living in Cox's Bazar?
Yeah, I have feel here in after 2017. We already living here more than 3 years, almost 4 years.
Right, and you came from Myanmar, from Rakhine State?
Yeah.
The Rohingya people have faced so much tragedy over the last few years. If there's one message, Kin, that you would like to tell our listeners today, what would it be?
Yeah, this is the thing. We would like to request the international audience to put the Myanmar government to accept us, and we request the investigation. This is our message to all.
Kin Maung, the founder of the Rohingya Youth Association and a resident of the Rohingya camp that burned yesterday in Cox's Bazar, Bangladesh, forcing thousands to flee. Kin, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Okay, thank you for your time, and thank you.
Yesterday, we heard good news about the U.S. trial of the AstraZeneca vaccine, but today, U.S. vaccine officials pushed back and questioned the data, which has yet to be released. It adds to this vaccine's messy rollout in Europe. Several countries halted vaccinations to investigate a very small handful of possible rare side effects, but public health researchers are cautioning against putting too much focus on all this confusion.
No, it's another first time this kind of thing has happened, right, where we have new information, even if it turns out to be a false alarm.
That's Jillian Steele-Fisher, director of the Global Polling Unit at Harvard School of Public Health. She says there's a broader lesson to be learned from what is happening with AstraZeneca. The main global and European monitoring agencies reviewed the global safety data, found no proven links, and concluded that the benefits far outweigh the risks.
We should be glad that we have an alarm system, right? So it's that we're actually doing due diligence. We're actually making sure from the public health side, right, that these vaccines don't just kind of go out and we don't know what's happened to them. We follow up and we make sure that they're as effective in the community as they were in the trial.
The AstraZeneca vaccine is one of the main shots being used in the global pandemic response. It is not yet approved in the United States. Dr. Paul Offit with Children's Hospital of Philadelphia says he and others will be assessing all the data to ensure any vaccine is safe and effective. Dr. Offit is on the Independent Review Committee for COVID-19 vaccines in the U.S.
We want to make sure that these studies are done carefully and well before we would ever approve the vaccine for use in Americans.
Jillian Steele-Fisher says this should build even more assurance in vaccines so long as people understand the process and know that their concerns are being addressed.
We have an opportunity to build trust in the infrastructure.
The globe currently has an arsenal of several vaccines against COVID-19. So far, nearly 500 million doses have been administered worldwide. An Egyptian feminist icon died this weekend. Nawal El-Sadawi was a writer, doctor, and activist. Also, she was never one to shy away from controversy when it came to her views on religion and politics. To discuss her legacy, we're joined by another Egyptian feminist, writer, and activist, Mona El-Tahawi. Mona, you interviewed Dr. Nawal El-Sadawi a number of times. What are your memories of those encounters?
Well, I remember the very first time I encountered Nawal El-Sadawi was on television when my family lived in London on a documentary. And I remember that she terrified me because he was this really outspoken woman. And other Egyptians on the film were saying that she made Egypt look bad. So it was an early lesson in like the power and danger of feminists. And I was like, ooh, I want to know more about this woman. And then when I met her in Egypt in the early 90s, I would say, I was a young feminist journalist and thrilled to be meeting one of my feminist heroes, because along with the Moroccan feminist sociologist Fatima Mernissi, Nawal El-Sadawi's work was foundational to my feminism.
Like Nawal El-Sadawi, you've also never shied away from speaking your mind when it comes to women's rights. But for Sadawi, that was 1950s Egypt. Where do you think she gained that kind of courage in such a conservative society?
You know, one of the earliest things that she told me when I began to interview her in Cairo in the 1990s was she told me that one of her grandmothers taught her, this was a grandmother who could not read or write, taught her that God and religion were simple and there were just three things: freedom, love, and justice. And what a gift that was to be given by your grandmother, to be told that God and religion are freedom, love, and justice. And I think that that instilled in her a belief that no matter what the regime in Egypt said, no matter what the so-called religious authorities said, no matter what the United States as the world superpower said, she had a right to freedom, love, and justice.
It's interesting, both you and Nawal Sadawi actively supported the 2011 revolution in Egypt. How do you think she saw things changing for Egyptian women? And do you think at least some of the ideals she was mapping out were realized?
Well, you know, one of the things that she did, and it was a threat, I was not in Cairo during the 18 days of the revolution, she was, and it was thrilling to see this 80, you know, she was in her 80s, this woman being honored, a feminist icon being honored, you know, at the heart of our revolution. And soon after the revolution, she revived the Egyptian Women's Union, and it brought around her men and women who were determined to introduce and insist into the revolution represent gender equality, because the revolution did not have gender equality at its beginning. It had wonderful goals: bread, liberty, social justice, human dignity. But there wasn't this idea that this is also a revolution for gender equality. And she and the revival of the Egyptian Women's Union were determined to do that. And it was really powerful that it was young Egyptian men and women who were around her wanting to do that. So I think that when she would give interviews after the revolution, she would often say, there is no revolution without women. And we were a part of this revolution. And this revolution will succeed only with gender equality and with women at its heart.
So Mona, how do you see the struggle of Egyptian women today in Egypt, especially under President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi?
Well, you know, things are really grim for everyone in Egypt now, and especially so for Egyptian women. I mean, every week it's like a catalogue of patriarchal horrors. And I think what is happening in Egypt now, we are seeing the feminist revolution that Nawal was at the forefront of and that I've always wanted to see all my life. Because last year in Egypt, an unprecedented number of Egyptian women began to expose sexual violence in incredibly courageous ways. And at the same time, and this is necessary for the feminist revolution too, and this connects us to Nawal's work against female genital mutilation and tying her advocacy against FGM to women's right to sexual pleasure, an unprecedented number of Egyptian women are talking about sex openly. I have never seen so many social media accounts in Egypt in Arabic talking about sex, talking about pleasure, talking about joy. So I think that Nawal's work continues. I think Nawal has given us broad, broad shoulders on which to stand. And on my social media account every day, I see women from around the world, but especially from Egypt and our part of the world, eulogize Nawal and vow to her that we will continue our feminist revolution.
Is there a moment from any of your meetings with Nawal el-Sadawi that you'll always refer to as kind of who she is, what she represents?
I think when Nawal told me that her grandmother told her God and religion were freedom, love, and justice, I have never forgotten those terms. So Nawal's grandmother was born in the 1800s. Nawal was born in 1931. I was born in 1967. So this idea of Egyptian women passing on the baton of freedom, love, and justice has stayed with me. I am now 53 years old, and she told me this when I was maybe 23, 24, 25, something like that. So the fact that those three words stayed with me for 30 years says everything about the inspiration that Nawal Sadawi was.
Feminist writer and activist Mona El-Tahawi, thank you very much for helping us remember Nawal El-Sadawi.
Thank you for having me, Marco.
There is another way for us to connect. Subscribe to our newsletter and get a daily dose of global news sent right to your inbox. Sign up at theworld.org/newsletters. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and thanks for listening.